Diana seemed to be the opposite of Arius, warm, genuine, and sincere. After inviting me in, she directed me to the breakfast nook off the kitchen, where we sat down at a table. Travis's dog, Napoleon, had been outside when I arrived, and as soon as he saw me through the sliding glass door, he started to bark, so Diana let him in to meet me. His tail was wagging as he sniffed at my hands, snorting. He looked old, but appeared to be well taken care of and in good spirits. I found myself thinking back to that first walkthrough at Travis's home when it was still a crime scene, and how Flores and I wondered whether the dog had been cared for during the days that Travis had been upstairs lying dead on the shower floor. Napoleon had been in the house during Travis's murder, a four-legged witness to the identity of the killer. Diana had 21 handwritten letters on the table ready for me to take back to Arizona. All but one was still in its original envelope. I chose not to read them in front of her, as I understood they were private in nature. When I later reviewed them, I saw that they were the kind of letters a boyfriend would write to a girlfriend with whom he is in love. Diana agreed to let us keep the original letters for our investigation, but requested that we mail her back copies, as the sentiments they contained were very meaningful to her. As soon as I arrived back in Phoenix, I turned the letters Diana had given me over to the Arizona Department of Public Safety for a handwriting analysis by Alan Kreitel, an experienced document examiner. Not long after, I spoke with another of Travis's friends, a young woman named Sky Hughes, who told me she had also been contacted by defense counsel Lawrence Nurmi in regard to one of the Bob White letters. Sky and her husband Chris were among Travis's closest friends. The Hugheses were members of the Church of Latter-day Saints, and Chris was Travis's colleague and mentor at PPL. I spoke with Sky over the telephone to learn the circumstances under which she had been contacted. After introducing myself as the prosecutor in the Arius case, I asked if she would be willing to speak to me about her interactions with defense counsel, and she was happy to cooperate. She told me that Nurmi had contacted her in early June 2010 to alert her to the existence of a letter that he claimed contained offensive information about Travis. Nurmi also informed her that the letter had been 100% verified by a handwriting analysis as having been penned by Travis. Sky explained that Nurmi had followed up his call with an email to which he attached a copy of that one letter. To relieve your initial concern, it contains no graphic images, but I suspect you will find the contents disturbing, Nurmi wrote as part of the accompanying email, in which he also provided his reason for sharing the letter with Sky instead of waiting to show it to her at a pretrial interview he had scheduled. By providing it to you now, you won't have to see it for the first time in the view of strangers. Sky admitted to being upset when she first read the letter, believing it to be authentic. But like Diana Reed, upon further review, she became certain that Travis could not have written it, nor could he have done the things the letter alleged. Once again, a defense attempt to enlist the help of one of Travis's friends came up empty. A few days later, I received a call from Kreitel informing me that the signatures on the 10 Bob White letters had probably not been executed by Travis Alexander. He explained that because all 10 were copies and not the originals, he was unable to reach a definite conclusion. The poor quality of the second-generation copies prevented him from going forward with a more complete examination. Kreitel's expert determination that the letters were likely forgeries bolstered my belief that they had been created for the sole purpose of supporting Arius's self-defense claim, but I wanted more definitive proof that I could use to discredit them. I knew that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office conducted random searches of all inmates' cells, including Jody Arius's. So I called the office's intelligence unit, asking whether they had seized any contraband items from her cell. My interest was piqued when one of the intelligence officers told me that they had confiscated a number of postcards from her cell and that I could view them. I put aside my other work and drove to the Estrella Jail, about 7 miles from my office. When I arrived, the intelligence officer was waiting for me and escorted me to a room in the office adjacent to the security desk, where about 50 postcards that had been sent to Arias during her stay at the jail were waiting for me to review. They had been seized as contraband because Arias had evidently peeled the top layer of paper, the layer with writing on it, off the back of each one so that she could reuse them, which was a violation of jail policy. I had been sifting through the pile for a few minutes when I came upon a number of blank 3x5 index cards. One of them caught my eye because it had writing on one side. A while back, Travis's sister Samantha had shown me similar cards on which Travis had written out daily to-do lists. I had also seen one of these 3x5 cards pictured in a crime scene photograph taken by police in Travis's office. The upper right-hand corner of each card was dated, and one side of the card was lined, with Travis's numbered lists on the unlined backside. These lists were a mixture of aphorisms and encouragement, visualize, prayer, finish goals, with practical tasks and chores, water grass, work out, yoga, fold clothes, wash linens, dust, mop floor. The lists were often numbered up to 15 or 16 and were always written in this concise style. I was somewhat familiar with Travis's handwriting, having read his journal and the Deanna Reed letters, and the handwriting on the 3x5 card from the jail looked very similar. It seemed an odd coincidence because the subject matter being addressed on this card could not have been more different from Travis's to-do lists. In blue ink it said, "Just so you know, I followed you, so don't try to play stupid later when I ask you where you were and with whom. And if you don't answer your phone tonight, I'll know you're just a whore. P.S. Anyone who takes you to that dive is a loser." As soon as I read that message, I began to doubt that this card had been written by Travis. The tone of the message was different from all of the index card lists I'd seen. Travis's lists were always fragments, never complete sentences, and never angry or emotional. This message was clearly addressed to someone else, unlike the to-do lists that he had on his index cards. When I brought the index cards to the attention of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, they were unable to determine how they had been smuggled into the jail or how Arias came into their possession. After I prepared and served a subpoena, the cards were released at my request to Detective Flores, who picked them up and submitted them to Alan Kreidel so that he could review the handwriting in one of them alongside the letters. While waiting to hear from Kreidel, I filled my weeks with work on other cases, as well as continuing to review selected portions of the Arias investigation in depth. At times, my attention to the case bordered on the obsessive, to the point that I couldn't get the card out of my mind. I wanted to know what it was for and, more importantly, how Arias was using it. Concerned that perhaps I had missed something, I arranged to return to the jail and review the pack again. My follow-up visit to the jail, which took place on August 4, 2011, did not turn up anything that I hadn't already seen. But as I lingered in the waiting area talking with the intelligence officer, I saw a woman with short cropped hair and rimmed glasses entering the facility. I recognized her as a friend of Jody Arias's named Ann Campbell, who had attended a number of Arias's court hearings. I watched as she went to the window to fill out the paperwork requesting an inmate visit with Arias. I was surprised when she turned and fixed her gaze on me before breaking into a grin. "They're up to something, and I know it, and there is nothing we can do about it," I said to the intelligence officer. She didn't say anything, just nodded. All we could do was stand there and watch as Campbell was allowed inside to visit Arias. Not long after, I headed for the parking lot to return to the office. Perhaps my comment struck a chord, because I'd only been on the road for about 5 minutes when I got a call on my cell phone from the intelligence officer, directing me to come back to the jail. She had something to show me, and the urgency in her voice suggested that it couldn't wait. Upon my return, I was led to the same office adjacent to the security desk where I was shown two magazines. One was an issue of Star, dated July 25, 2011. The other, an August 2011 edition of Digital Photo Pro. Arias requested that these magazines be turned over to Ann Campbell, the officer told me, directing me to have a look at them. Nothing of note jumped out at me as I leafed through the pages of Digital Photo Pro. I don't see anything, I said.
Are you sure? Turn to page 20, the officer instructed.
I slowly scanned the page and noticed the words, "You testify so," written in pencil along the right edge next to the magazine's spine.
Okay, now go to page 37.
Flipping ahead 17 pages, the words, "We can fix this," jumped out at me.
Well, I'll be, I remarked.
Give me another.
Page 43, the officer smiled.
You fucked up. What you told my attorney the next day, I said, reciting aloud the words scrawled across the top of this page.
How did you find these? I asked, awestruck at Arias's attempt to clandestinely communicate with someone outside the jail.
The officer explained that she hadn't noticed the concealed messages when she first skimmed the magazines, and neither had her sergeant, who had also perused them in the dim light of their office. But a gnawing feeling prompted the officer to further scrutinize the magazines, first by raising the lights in the room, which yielded no results, and then by taking them to another room with brighter lighting to comb through them one last time. It was then that she noticed some writing on one of the pages in Digital Photo Pro. Grabbing both publications, she returned to the office adjacent to the security desk, where she enlisted the help of another officer to make sure they found all the messages hidden on the pages. Grabbing a sheet of paper, the two officers pored over the pages of Digital Photo Pro, writing down the page numbers and the cryptic message associated with each page. 20. You testify so. 37. We can fix this. 40. Directly contradicts what I have been saying for over a year. 43. You fucked up. What you told my attorney the next day. 54. Interview was excellent! Exclamation point. Must talk ASAP! Exclamation point. 56. Get down here ASAP and see me before you talk to them again and before. When they were done, they knew they had a message intended for somebody outside the jail, but they couldn't understand its meaning. Then they turned their attention to Star magazine, featuring a smiling Casey Anthony on the upper left-hand corner of its cover. They looked slowly through every page, finding nothing until they reached page 82, the last page of the magazine. There, along the bottom border of the page, also written in pencil, they found the following numbers in this order: 43, 40, 56, 20, 37, 54. When they rearranged the messages on those particular pages of Digital Photo Pro in that order, they realized they had decoded what were obviously instructions to someone outside of jail to do Arias's bidding. 43, you fucked up. What you told my attorney next day, 40, contradicts what I've been saying for over a year, 56. Get down here ASAP and see me before you talk to them again, and before, 20, you testify, so, 37, we can fix this, 54. Interview was excellent. Must talk ASAP. If I had any doubts that Arias would stop at nothing, including changing a witness's story, they evaporated as I read this attempted communication, in which she even cursed in violation of her Mormon faith, which prohibited profanity. After preparing and serving another subpoena deuces tecum, I immediately called Detective Flores, who agreed to drive to the Estrella jail to pick up the publications and take them to the Mesa Police Department so they could be held securely should they be needed in any future court proceedings. When Flores arrived, we discussed the implications and consequences of what we had just found,
and I was tempted to tell him about Daryl Brewer's interview summary where he had revealed to the defense investigator that Arias had told him she intended to travel to Mesa before she took her trip in early June. This was the closest I came to disclosing the existence of the gas cans to him, although as the trial neared, there would be other times where I thought about it. But while the intelligence officer had managed to foil the delivery of Arias's outgoing message, I still didn't know who the magazines were intended for or how they were going to be used. Driving back to the office from the jail, I started to think more about the timing of the attempted secret communication. As I focused on both the date and the message itself, it became clear there was nothing coincidental about the timing. The court had scheduled a hearing in 4 days, on August 8th, where I would challenge the credibility of the Bob White letters and attempt to preclude them from being introduced as evidence at trial. It appeared that the cryptic messages in the magazines were somehow linked to the upcoming hearing. Arias was clearly trying to communicate with someone regarding his or her potential testimony. Whoever the intended recipient of the magazines was, he or she was most likely planning to give testimony that would support Arias's claim about the authenticity of the White letters. The problem that Arias was attempting to remedy, according to the note in the magazines, was that the story this person had told to Arias's lawyers didn't line up with what Arias herself had been saying for over a year. Because all phone calls are recorded, she couldn't risk conveying that message via the telephone, so she had to resort to the magazine route instead. With the coded message, it appeared that Arias was trying to influence the person to testify to her version of the truth, tampering with someone who would likely be a witness on her behalf. In the days before the August 8th hearing, I disclosed the existence of the magazines to the defense. I also disclosed the results of Kreidel's analysis of the writing on the index card found in Arias's cell. He had concluded that the writings on that card were an attempt by the writer to simulate Travis's handwriting. He reached this conclusion after comparing the writing on the index card to the handwriting samples that were known to have been written by Travis, including his two journals and the letters to Deanna Reed. This final detail about the 3x5 card brought everything about the White letters into sharp focus. It was obvious that the 10 letters disclosed by defense counsel to the state were forged, and it seemed that Jody Arias had forged them, as it appeared she had practiced simulating Travis's handwriting on the card while she was at the Maricopa County Jail. When August 8th arrived, I presented my case, calling 4 witnesses, beginning with Deanna Reed and Alan Kreitel, to prove that the White letters should be precluded from any part of the trial. The witnesses' testimony combined to paint a clear picture that the letters were forged, with Kreitel's handwriting analysis making the most compelling argument. Under direct examination, Kreidel cited several differences he had found when comparing the content of the 10 White letters with those provided by Deanna Reed. For one, the spacing in the White letters was much tighter than in Travis's letters. The letters known to have been written by Travis also didn't contain dates, while the questioned ones all had dates in the upper right-hand corner of the page. In comparing the signatures on the 2 sets of letters, Kreidel found that the size of the signatures on the known letters was much larger than the signatures on the questioned ones. He also observed that the height relationship between the letter R and the letter A in the name Travis on the questioned documents was different than on the authentic ones. But my case did not end with Kreidel and the other witnesses I had already called to testify. I also planned to call additional witnesses, including the deputy from the jail who had discovered the coded messages in the magazines. By bringing the magazines into the discussion, my plan was to show that the coded messages were connected to the Bob White letters, indicating that Arias was trying to tamper with a witness who she was asking to testify to their authenticity. Only it didn't work out quite that way. The following day, August 9th, the court allowed the defense to call a witness preemptively to challenge the prosecution's account of the magazines before I'd had a chance to show their connection to this hearing. The witness was Heather Niederauer, a fellow inmate of Arias's, who testified that she had written the messages in the magazines as a way to communicate with her co-defendant in an impending case. As implausible as this testimony was, what was even more strange was that the person interrogating Niederauer was not Nurmi or Washington, but Jody Arias herself, who had elected to proceed propria persona, or pro per, acting as her own lawyer for the purposes of these proceedings. The result was that for the first time, Arias and I were on opposite sides of the debate, addressing each other directly without an intermediary. The seating arrangements in the courtroom also changed, with Arias now sitting in the lead counsel's chair just 2 feet away from me. This shift in roles moved Arias from quiet spectator to active participant, meaning that she could now make objections, question witnesses, and introduce or object to any evidence. Even though she had taken over the first counsel's chair, both figuratively and literally, she was still in her jail garb, a 2-piece pantsuit of black and white stripes from top to bottom. And instead of the ballpoint pen commonly used by lawyers to take notes, she was allowed only a 3-inch yellow golf pencil, which required her to continuously sharpen its point throughout the proceedings. If her lack of legal experience intimidated Arias, she didn't show it. But in her eagerness to begin the questioning of her witness, she started her examination before Niederauer had even been sworn in, a fact that was not lost on the courtroom clerk, who interrupted Arias by indicating to the judge she hasn't been sworn, referring to the witness. Judge Sherry Stevens said to Niederauer, "Yes, you need to stand and be sworn." Arias waited as Niederauer stated her name and recited her legal oath before jumping back in with her questions. "You have already stated your name," she began. "Can you just tell us why you're here?"
"I'm here to testify that I wrote something in a book," Niederauer replied, seeming to misstate her answer.
"Okay. Do you remember what?" "You said a book?" Arias said, in an attempt to coach Niederauer to correct her blunder. Apparently, the witness picked up Arias's cue to modify her answer, because she gave the desired response.
"Magazine."
As Arias continued with the direct examination, it appeared her focus was no longer on the witness as she turned her eyes to the back of the courtroom.
"Okay. So did you... you wrote something in a magazine? Okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'd like to remind the court the rule has been invoked. We have a witness in the room," she told Judge Stevens, referring to Deanna Reed, who was sitting in the gallery listening to the testimony.
Arias's comment to the judge was referencing Rule 615 of the Arizona Rules of Evidence, which requires the court to exclude witnesses from the courtroom who will be called to testify so they cannot hear the testimony of others. When I pointed out that Deanna Reed had already testified at this hearing and was no longer a witness in this case, Arias responded, "She's still a trial witness."
"Is she going to be a trial witness?" Judge Stevens asked, directing her question at me.
"Not for the state at this point," I replied. The judge next asked Arias, "Are you planning on calling her?" Arias avowed that she would be calling Reed as a witness at trial, and therefore the judge had no choice but to exclude Deanna from the proceedings. 3 years had passed since her arrest, and it appeared Arias still harbored resentment toward Deanna for the place that she held in Travis's life, and her request that Deanna be excused appeared to be merely a ploy to prove that she was in control. With Deanna now out of the courtroom, Arias refocused her attention on Niederauer.
"Okay, so what about the magazine brings you here today?" she asked. "I wrote something to... a message for my boyfriend to give to a co-defendant of mine."
"And do you remember which magazine you wrote the message in?"
"Digital Camera Magazine," Niederauer replied, citing the name incorrectly.
"And what about the other magazine?"
The other was the Star magazine, and it had the pages circled, she replied. This, too, was an erroneous fact, as I knew the numbers found on the page of Star had not been circled, and I intended to assertively point that out to Niederauer during my cross-examination. So, in the Star magazine, you indicated certain pages in reference to the Digital Pro magazine? Arius continued, perhaps hoping to remind her witness of the correct name of the magazine that had contained the cryptic messages. Yes, was Niederauer's one-word response. And so that would contain the message in the digital... Objection leading, I interjected. Sustained, Judge Stevens ruled. Sorry. So the message was for whom? Sorry. Arius continued, seeming slightly taken aback by my opposition to her question and apologizing not once, but twice. When Niederauer provided the name of the supposed intended recipient of the magazines, Arius asked her final question. Your co-defendant? To which Niederauer replied in the affirmative. Yes, ma'am. Well, I think that's it, Arius said before returning to her chair at the defense table. She had posed just 10 questions, and she was done. I waited for her to sit down before starting with my first question. Ma'am, one of the things you indicated to us just now was that the pages were circled, right? I began. The witness offered up a more specific reply, which was equally incorrect. The numbers for the pages were circled, on the third page in the back. On the back of it you circled the page numbers? I asked, confirming her response. Yes. And with regard to the other magazine that contained messages, you indicated that you were the one that wrote whatever messages were on there, right? Yes. And you wrote them on the left margins, right? I put them all different places, like in the seam of the book, on the top of the book, in the little areas where there's clean pieces of paper on the magazine. And that was on the photo magazine, correct? And then the Star magazine is the one with the page numbers? Those are the ones that are circled? Niederauer again affirmed that the numbers in Star magazine were circled, which was problematic because when she was shown the magazine, she couldn't find the page on which the numbers were written. She also claimed to know that the issue of Star she had wanted Ann Campbell to deliver to her co-defendant had a photo of Casey Anthony on the cover, but when I asked her to describe where on the cover Ms. Anthony's photo was located, she could not provide an answer, seeming not to actually know who Anthony was or what she looked like. Where would Casey Anthony's picture be? I asked, holding up the issue in question. On the cover, she replied. What part of the cover? I don't know, was Niederauer's reply. Even looking at it, you don't know where it is? No. Niederauer also testified that she had gotten the issue of Star at the end of June or beginning of July, which was impossible as the weekly magazine was dated July 25, 2011. I don't know, maybe I have the wrong date, the witness conceded. Or maybe you are not telling the truth, I retorted. At the close of my cross-examination, Arius stood and performed her redirect examination. Through a series of simply worded questions, Arius worked to re-establish that Niederauer had indeed been the one who had written the messages in Digital Photo Pro and the corresponding page numbers in Star. But after failing in her attempt to rehabilitate her witness, she tried to place the blame on me for Niederauer's erroneous statement that she had circled those numbers. So I don't recall you saying that you circled the pages in the interview. Juan said that. I was prepared for the fight, and before Arius could even finish her sentence, I stood to voice my objection. I am going to object to the defendant testifying, I declared. The record speaks for itself. Okay, Arius acknowledged, shrinking back on that accusation to put forth another equally improbable excuse. Is it possible you're mixed up? Yes, Niederauer said, grabbing the bait. You don't remember exactly when you wrote in the magazine? Arius coached, prompting me to object once again. Sustained, Judge Stevens ruled, and directed Arius to rephrase her question. This was the first hearing at which I cross-examined a witness presented by Arius and in her presence, so she hadn't known how to prepare Niederauer for my manner of questioning. Niederauer's account did not hold up under scrutiny, and the testimony ended up assisting the prosecution. More than that, the experience proved useful in other ways. After years of seeing how Arius manipulated situations and people to her advantage, it was instructive to watch as she floundered in a courtroom where rules are non-negotiable. After Niederauer stepped down from the witness stand, the hearing was continued until August 15th, when I was expected to call the remaining witnesses and Arius would question them, continuing to act as her own lawyer. But when we arrived on August 15th to resume the hearing, there was a change in the proceedings. Arius had chosen to stop representing herself, and after the reappointment of Nurmi and Washington as defense counsel, I was surprised when they withdrew their objection to my request that the letters be excluded from use during the trial. And with that, the letters were gone from the case. Even though Nurmi had claimed to Sky Hughes that the authenticity of the letter he showed her had been verified by a handwriting expert, this claim had fallen apart under closer scrutiny. It was an abrupt reversal, and defense counsel never gave a reason to the court for their decision agreeing to withdraw the letters. Whatever the defense counsel's rationale for withdrawing them, the case had a new reality. Without the Bob White letters to aid her, Arius's claim of self-defense was weakened substantially, because it was based solely on her uncorroborated word. She had painted herself into a corner with her different stories, and now had no choice but to stay the course with this one. Chapter 12. Though I'd successfully dealt with the Bob White letters, they were only part of the problem. I still had to contend with the instant messages and various electronic communications that portrayed Travis as someone who was quick to anger and used sexually offensive language toward Arius. These messages and words were probably going to be admissible, and they seemed to support Arius's claim that Travis could be verbally and physically abusive, and, at times, sexually inappropriate. I needed to find a way to counter this interpretation of the messages. Rather than challenging Travis's written words, I chose to focus on what might have provoked his angry missives, which meant looking more closely at his constant antagonist, Jody Arius. There had to be a reason, even a bad one, to help explain his harsh written outbursts. In Arius's telling, Travis was the sexual aggressor of the two, while she was the more passive one, a self-characterization that helped form the foundation of her self-defense argument. The electronic correspondence showed them both to be sexually aggressive in their own ways, and a different story of what was going on between them appeared to unfold. Travis may have had his moments of harsh words for Arius, but his messages like three-hole wonder did not seem indicative of his behavior throughout their relationship. Those harsh moments were just that, moments. They showed all too clearly that there were times when Arius could push Travis too far, and like anyone pushed so hard, he got angry. Combined with the shame and guilt that he was already feeling toward himself as a religious person in this highly sexual relationship, there were times when her antagonism resulted in words that he couldn't take back. This didn't make his lashing out acceptable on any level, but viewed through this lens, it was clear that these charged moments of anger were the exceptions, not the rule. In order to counter the idea that Arius was simply a passive figure and Travis a constant sexual aggressor, I needed to move beyond the instant messages and emails, which would always be open to interpretation from either side, depending on who was discussing them. I began to think back to what I knew of her previous relationships. I remembered reading something which spoke to Arius's demeanor in an intimate setting during the interview that the defense investigator had done with Daryl Brewer back on October 6, 2008, the interview that had first put me on the trail of the gas cans. So I pulled out the binder with his summary to verify my recollection. When the investigator had asked Brewer about his intimate relationship with Arias, Brewer had talked about when they first met. The first time, she was pretty aggressive, he recalled when speaking to the investigator, describing Arias as enthusiastic and always comfortable sexually and with intimacy. Turning this information over anew, it was intriguing how different Brewer's characterization of Arias was from the way she was portraying herself now that she was claiming she had killed Travis in self-defense. I wanted to find out if Arias had been as sexually forward with Ryan Burns as she had been with Daryl Brewer. She had visited him in Utah less than 24 hours after she'd been intimate with Travis before she killed him. So I wanted to find out how sexually appropriate she had been with Burns, especially after having rolled around in Travis's bed a day before. To prepare myself for my call to Burns, I decided to review the telephonic interview police had conducted with him on June 25, 2008. The information he had provided to them was silent with regard to any sexual interplay that he and Arias may have had. But my review was not in vain, as I did find another discrepancy in the story Arias had told Burns about why her cell phone hadn't been working during the drive from California to Utah. Burns told police that Arias called him on Tuesday, June 3, 2008, at around 11 p.m. to let him know she had just left the Monterey area and would be arriving in Utah the following day. He didn't hear from her again until approximately 20 hours later, when she phoned him the evening of June 4th, claiming to have driven in the wrong direction, gotten lost, and run out of gas. She told Burns she had just passed a highway sign that read 100 miles to Las Vegas, which would put her on Highway 93 north, passing through Kingman, Arizona. Her stated reason for not contacting Burns sooner was that she had forgotten her cell phone charger and turned off her phone to save the battery. This was in stark contrast to what she had told Detective Flores on July 15, 2008, just after her arrest in Yreka. During that conversation, Arias claimed that her cell phone had powered off on its own just east of Pasadena, California, and it wasn't until she found her cell phone charger, which had lodged itself under the passenger side seat, that she was able to power it on north of Kingman. That Arias had told two different stories about the cell phone charger, one to Burns and the other to law enforcement, during an official police interview, convinced me even more that she had deliberately powered off her cell phone to avoid being detected in Arizona. This certainly spoke to her premeditation of the murder, because it was another step she took, knowing it would be impossible for police to electronically track her movements if her phone was powered off. This became one more point I didn't want to forget to discuss with Burns on the phone. It was mid-morning when I reached Burns on his cell phone, and from the outset he sounded eager to cooperate. I explained that I had some questions for him that had not been covered during his interview with police, assuring him that I was not recording our conversation or taking notes. I avoid using a recorder when I speak with witnesses because I want them to be comfortable knowing there is no recording device, and I don't take notes because I don't want to stop the flow of the conversation by asking the person to repeat something to enable me to write it down. "I am happy to tell you what I know," Burns said. I didn't want to initiate the conversation with questions about his intimate relationship with Arias, so I began by asking him about his living situation. He explained that back in June 2008, he had resided with his parents in West Jordan, a suburb of Salt Lake City, but that his quarters were private and separated from the rest of the house. Next, I asked him about Arias's failure to arrive in Utah on the morning of June 4th, as she had promised, and he indicated that he'd started to worry when she didn't turn up as scheduled. As the hours passed without hearing from her, he grew increasingly concerned and called around to mutual acquaintances in the Salt Lake City area, hoping that they had heard something. It struck me that his community was close-knit, and he felt comfortable calling others to share his concern. When he learned that no one had heard from her, there was nothing he could do but wait and hope she was okay. Burns told me that it wasn't until later that evening, while out to dinner with two friends at the Cheesecake Factory, that he finally received a call from Arius, claiming she had gotten lost and would be in Utah sometime the following morning. Burns recalled that she was in good spirits and was looking forward to seeing him. When she finally arrived the next day and greeted him outside his front door, he told me he was surprised to see that she was now a brunette, since she'd been a blonde when he first met her. "You're a lucky guy that girls come to see you," I said, trying to move the conversation to the more pertinent topic of their physical relationship. I knew that Ryan Burns was Mormon, and I wanted to be respectful, but I needed to find out what had happened during their brief time together. When I asked if they had kissed, he revealed that Arius was more than a willing participant, as she kissed him first. Burns described the kiss as passionate, so I asked him if anything else had happened. He admitted that the two had engaged in sexual behavior the only night she was in Utah. He explained that after attending a PPL meeting in Salt Lake City, the two went to dinner with friends and then back to his house, where they watched a movie together. He recalled that Arius was tired, so the two lay down on his bed for a nap so she could get a few hours of sleep before starting her drive back to California. Upon waking, according to Burns, they engaged in romantic kissing and grinding of their pelvic areas, with Arius straddling him while the two were fully clothed. Listening to Burns' narrative, it was surprising to hear that Arius would be so intimate and aggressive with him, given what, according to her, she'd just been through with Travis. After all, if her version of events was to be believed, less than 2 days earlier she'd slept with Travis, who had caused her to fear for her life to the point that she'd killed him. And yet, in spite of all this apparent emotional trauma that she'd experienced, here she was with Burns, carrying on in a sexual manner as though nothing had happened. "Did anything unusual happen while you guys were together?" I asked. It was then that Burns told me something that had not been mentioned in the police report. Shortly after Arius arrived at his house on June 5th, the two drove in separate cars to a restaurant where they were meeting friends for lunch before going to the PPL seminar. It was around noon and he was driving in front of her when he looked in his rearview mirror and noticed that she had been pulled over by a member of the West Jordan City Police Department. He watched as Arius spoke briefly with the police officer and was allowed to drive on without being cited. Once they arrived at the restaurant, Burns asked her what had happened with the cop, and she explained that he'd pulled her over because her rear license plate was affixed upside down. She claimed that some kids had been goofing around near the front of her car while she'd been inside a restaurant while driving through California. She added that when she came out to the parking lot, the kids saw her approaching, dropped the front license plate, and took off laughing. She'd picked up the plate and put it in the back seat of her car, telling Burns those kids were the ones responsible for removing the back license plate and replacing it upside down. At the end of my call with Burns, I was anxious to know more about what had happened with the traffic stop, so I attempted to get a copy of the police report detailing the events. I phoned the police station in West Jordan and was told that a report of the traffic stop had not been generated because Arius had not been cited. I know that each dispatch operator also generates another, less detailed report, and I immediately called the dispatch center and requested the event log for the traffic stop. The log did not include much information, but it did indicate the name of the police officer, Michael Gallietti, and the time of 12:03 p.m. when he had pulled Arius over on June 5th. After leaving a message for him, Officer Gallietti returned my call, and I asked about the traffic stop, hoping he remembered pulling Arius over. As it turned out, he remembered the stop quite well, saying it was the only time in his career where he had seen a car being driven with a rear license plate affixed upside down. He also said that there was no front license plate on the car when he stopped it that day, and remembered that the driver was a woman whom he identified as Jody Arius. When I asked if she had provided an explanation, he told me that during traffic stops he hears a lot of stories, and hers was that her friends, not strangers, must be playing a joke on me. It was impressive that Arius was able to spin a spur-of-the-moment tale so convincingly that she was able to talk a police officer out of giving her a ticket for the infraction. And once again, just like with her story about the cell phone charger, she'd told Ryan Burns one thing and law enforcement another. With these two competing versions revealing her untruthfulness, it seemed evident that Arius had removed both license plates before she arrived at Travis's house in Mesa in the early morning hours of June 4th. This would have made it difficult for anyone to identify the vehicle should it have been seen at or near Travis's house. She had apparently never put the front license plate back on the car and had remounted the back one upside down, leading to the stop by Officer Gallietti. After my conversations with Burns and Gallietti, I made the decision that I was going to call both of them to testify, and, as required by the rules, I filed a notice letting defense counsel know of my intention. As with every other potential prosecution witness, defense counsel indicated that they wished to speak to Burns and Gallietti so that they could ask them questions and tape record their answers. Rather than inconvenience the two individuals with a trip to Arizona, I informed defense counsel Lawrence Nurmi that the interviews would take place in Utah, and as is my normal practice, I would also be present during the interviews, not to interrupt or question, but simply to observe. The conversation Nurmi had with Ryan Burns was conducted in an interview room at the West Jordan City Police Department. Nurmi was a hulking man with close-cropped hair and rimmed glasses. He was dressed casually in contrast to my dress shirt and tie, and he had a legal pad in front of him that he would refer to while asking questions, along with a tape recorder. Burns was in his late 20s, approximately 6 feet tall, with red hair and green eyes. We all sat at the table, and I began the dialogue by thanking Burns for coming. I let him know that Mr. Nurmi was one of the lawyers for Jody Arius and wanted to ask him some questions. During these kinds of interviews, my attention is always focused on the witness, not defense counsel, as I am looking to see their demeanor and style in answering questions, as well as their level of composure. Burns had an air of confidence, and I sensed that he would tell the story as he remembered it without being unduly influenced by the question. Nothing emerged from Burns's interview that was of a surprising nature, except I realized that he was 3 years younger than Arius. I wasn't timing the interview, but it seemed like about 30 minutes had passed when Nurmi indicated that he had no more questions, and I let Burns know the interview was over and again thanked him for making himself available. That same morning, Nurmi also interviewed four other potential witnesses who were either acquaintances of Arius's or had interacted with her on June 5, 2008, when she traveled to Utah. Among those interviewed was a woman named Leslie Udy. Udy lived in the Salt Lake City area and had met Arius through prepaid legal. On the evening of June 5, 2008, Udy, Arius, Burns, and a few others had dined at Chili's. Arius had driven her to the restaurant that night and told Udy that she and Travis weren't together anymore, but she could imagine them both married to other people and socializing at PPL events where their kids would play together. Our next interview was at the Cottonwood Heights Police Department, about 10 miles away, where Officer Michael Gallietti now worked. Nurmi and I drove in separate cars, and he apparently got lost on the way because he was approximately 30 minutes late. When he finally arrived, Nurmi apologized to Officer Gallietti, who ushered us into a room just inside the lobby. Nurmi and I sat down, turned on our tape recorders, and the interview began. This interview was also short, just about 30 minutes, with Nurmi asking Gallietti about the circumstances of the traffic stop. Officer Gallietti was in uniform and appeared to be in his late 50s. He was poised in his responses and confident of his information. He came across as someone who was observant and paid close attention to details and could still remember what happened when he made a traffic stop of the car driven by Jody Arius. I'd initially called Ryan Burns to talk about his sexual interaction with Arius and ended up learning something about the traffic stop. But that's how cases are. There is always a dash of luck in every one of them, and this one was proving no different. I'd found something compelling, another part of the plan in Arius's scheme to kill Travis. Taken with everything else I'd learned, it was clear that this was not a crime of passion where Arius just reacted or the situation got out of control. This was a killing that had been well thought out to include such fine details as removing license plates to avoid being detected. This was premeditation down to the last gallon of gas. Chapter 13. I had almost missed the signposts on Jody Arius's road to Mesa, but I was now beginning to understand what fueled her motivation for the road trip to Arizona. Her overnight journey across the desert that June 4th wasn't to enjoy the weather. The high in Pasadena was around 70 degrees, while in Mesa it was slightly over 100. Arius wasn't coming to visit friends, either. She hid her itinerary from others. It most certainly wasn't a religious pilgrimage. She didn't even stop at the Mormon temple. It went beyond hiding a visit to enjoy a sexual tryst, no matter how much premarital sex was forbidden by her religion. The trip was a journey that would bring permanent closure to her relationship with Travis. She was going to end it by ending his life. Bringing 3 gas cans was just one part of her elaborate plan. To avoid missing any of her steps, I took a synergistic approach and detailed on my legal pad all the key elements leading to the killing. I had familiarized myself with this case to the point where I was intimate with the details of the investigation and could rely on that memory to formulate a timeline of Arius's preparations to carry out the murder. The trial was still a few months away, but preparation on this scale doesn't happen overnight. I started working on evenings and weekends when everyone was out of the office and I didn't have to worry about being interrupted. The office was hushed in a way that only happens after hours, and as I sat down at my desk, I turned around and looked out the window at the 4th Avenue jail, with its visitors streaming in to see the inmates. Looking outside was only a momentary distraction before turning my attention to the blank legal pad in front of me to begin summarizing the steps Arius had taken in premeditating Travis's murder. Arius's planning for the trip to Arizona had started in mid to late May, with the call to her ex-boyfriend Daryl Brewer requesting to borrow gas cans. This was the call that ended with her becoming frustrated with him for asking why she needed the cans. Even though she'd hung up without giving him a definitive schedule to pick up the containers, this call marked the first outward sign that Arius's plan had been put into motion. From there, she moved on to obtaining the gun. On Wednesday, May 28, 2008, she found that she had the house to herself for approximately 5 hours, and she used this opportunity to stage the break-in at her grandparents' house on Pine Street in Wairika, where she was living. Her objective was to take the .25-caliber handgun that belonged to her grandfather. This handgun would never be recovered, but the bullet casing found in Travis's bathroom matched the caliber of her grandfather's gun. During the investigation, Arius would confirm to Detective Flores that Travis did not own a gun, .25 caliber or otherwise, which showed that Arius had used the gun stolen from her grandparents' house to kill Travis, disposing of it after the crime. Around the same time as the break-in, Arius followed up with Daryl Brewer and called him again asking to borrow the 2 gas cans for her trip to Mesa. In a few days' time, she would show up at Brewer's house and take the containers with her. Her desire to travel in early June 2008 was not born out of a need to take time off from a job following months of hard work. She had only been employed for 1 week before her road trip. As she wrote in her journal, "Speaking of Casa Ramos, last night, Monday, May 26th, 2008, was my first night. It was cool. Everybody seems nice. I think I'll like it there." Arius came up with a cover story for taking the trip. She was going to visit Ryan Burns, a man she barely knew in West Jordan, Utah, a suburb of Salt Lake City. She mentioned Burns in a journal entry of May 27, 2008. He's fun to flirt with through text messaging, but hey, I like this guy. Well, so far, what I know about him, I like. 3 days later, on May 30th, Arias's journal entry spoke of her decision to travel to Utah to see Burns in the coming days. But according to her, he doesn't seem overly interested in me, although he seems happy that I am coming out to see him. It was perplexing that Arias had told her younger sister, Angela, that she saw Burns as her soulmate and future husband. Yet apparently she wasn't even sure if he was interested in her in a romantic way. Burns told police that the two agreed that he would wait for her to arrive at his place sometime in the morning on Wednesday, June 4th. Arias rented a car for her supposed trip to Utah on June 2, 2008, at the airport in Redding, a city approximately 90 miles south of Wairika. The person renting her the car remembered the transaction and, after identifying Arias in a photographic lineup, mentioned that her hair was blonde when he first met her. The picture in the lineup was Arias's mugshot taken after her arrest when her hair was brown. During her interaction with the rental car agent, she made up a story and told him that she was just going to be using the car for driving around locally. The first car offered to her had been red, but she had refused it because it might be more noticeable to law enforcement, deciding instead on a white Ford Focus. Obviously, any encounter with Arizona police would prove fatal to her plan of driving into and out of the state undetected. According to the only undated entry in any of her journals, Arias spent that evening, the first night of the trip, going out to dinner with one of her ex-boyfriends, Matthew McCartney, singing karaoke after meeting him at the Red Room in Santa Cruz. She wrote that McCartney bullied her into singing a duet to the song Cruisin'. She complained in the journal, "Not that I'm any better, but I totally carried him through that song." Even though Arias had told Detective Flores during her interview in Wairika that she was ambidextrous, I had come to understand that she only issued left-handed compliments, such as her pointing out that although saying McCartney could sing, it was her performance that carried the day. The next morning, June 3rd, Arias showed up at Daryl Brewer's house in Pacific Grove near Monterey at approximately 7:30 in the morning. She had breakfast with Brewer and his young son. Once they were done eating, Arias used Brewer's computer to check her email. She then took the 2 5-gallon gas cans and left. Arias stopped at the Washington Mutual branch office in Monterey and engaged in 3 bank transactions, the last one at 10:15 a.m. There was an approximately 4-hour gap between that transaction and the next time police were able to pick up her movements, based on a few time-stamped selfies she took en route to Salinas. Those photographs were found by police on her cell phone after her arrest. Because of the changing scenery outside her car window, it appears she was sitting behind the wheel of her rental car and driving while she took these selfies, the first of which was snapped at 2:12 p.m. What made them so significant was that they showed Arias as a brunette, which meant that at some time after she rented the car at the airport in Redding, she had dyed her hair from blonde to brown. A half smile is evident in 2 of the 3 pictures, while the last displays Arias's more serious side. But all 3 show her brown hair spilling past her neck and shoulders. Arias's next documented stop on June 3rd was Salinas, where she visited the Walmart at around 3:25 p.m. She purchased 5 items that afternoon, including another 5-gallon gas can to add to the 2 she had borrowed from Daryl Brewer. Her trip then took her to Pasadena, where she stopped at the Arco station shortly after 8:30 p.m. and filled both her gas tank and the 3 gas cans. Arias had ensured that the 3 containers would hold enough gasoline to guarantee she would not have to stop for gas in Arizona, so the police would not be able to place her in the state. She had also saved those gasoline receipts which, according to her, would support her claim that she had traveled directly from California to Utah. Making sure that her alibi was still in place, Arias called Ryan Burns sometime around 9 p.m. She assured him that she was on her way to Utah to see him and would be there in the late morning of the following day, June 4th, as previously discussed. What she didn't tell him was that she was going to drive through the night to visit Travis. She placed the call to this boyfriend in waiting shortly before she headed east on Interstate 10 toward Mesa. Not long after, on the night of June 3rd, Arias powered off her cell phone. She did not turn it back on until approximately 24 hours later in northern Arizona near the Nevada border, which ensured that police would not be able to electronically trace her detour. Arias's plan of driving through Arizona undetected was successful. No one remembered seeing either a brown-haired woman entering the house in Mesa in the early morning hours of June 4th, or a white Ford Focus parked in Travis's driveway. Tired from a long night of driving, Arias went to bed with Travis, waking up at around 1 p.m. I knew from the timestamps on the nude photographs that they began taking sexually explicit pictures at around 1:30 p.m. After this initial bedroom session in the mid-afternoon, Arias and Travis went downstairs, where they tried to look through the CDs of photos that she had brought with her of their travels, CDs whose very presence demonstrated that she had planned to visit Travis. The pair then had sex again before Travis, sometime shortly before 5:30 p.m., decided to take a shower, with Arias documenting his final moments on his Sanyo camera. The first stab wound ushering him to his death came while Travis was seated on the shower floor, followed by more stab wounds, which caused Travis to raise his hands to defend himself. He stood up and struggled to the sink, where Arias continued to stab him repeatedly on his shoulders. In an attempt to get away from the onslaught, Travis made his way down the hall, where Arias caught up with him and slit his throat as he was about to go into the bedroom. She continued the attack by dragging his body down the hallway to the blood-stained sink, where she shot him once in the head. She then continued to drag his body, finally stuffing Travis into the shower. It was at this point that Arias began the cleanup at the scene. She turned the shower on to wash away any biological evidence from Travis's body that could be tested later by DNA.